Welcome to Pacific Mammal Research's Marine Mammal Highlight Series. We are a 501c3 research and education nonprofit studying marine mammals in the Salish Sea off Washington State. In this series, you will learn about different marine mammals as we discuss interesting facts about each species. This is our way to geek out, share some information, and have some fun. We hope you enjoy the series, and be sure to follow us on Instagram to vote for which animal we talk about next. And without further ado, welcome to the Pac-Man podcast. I'm Cindy.
And I'm Kat.
And so this week is a marine mammal highlight. And we had our poll up, and we've only had this happen like once or twice before, but it was a dead heat, 50%, 50% between the harp seal and the, what was it, Galapagos sea lion, I think that we put on there.
I think so. Or was it the Galapagos fur seal, I think. I can't remember.
It was Galapagos something. Oh, here we go. Yes, it was the Galapagos first seal. I wrote it down. It's been so long. It's been like a few days. But anyway, yeah. So I honestly was surprised. I thought the harp seal was going to win out because it's the epitome of the cute, white, fluffy pup that everybody's seen. But it was 50-50. So that when that happens, it comes down to what we want to do. And I made the executive decision to do the harp seal because I like the cute little white fluffy seal. So. We're going to do the harp seal today.
Good decision.
Thank you. So we're excited to do this, to get going on this one. These are some very interesting guys. And like I said, this is, I think most people, when they think of seal, or a lot of people at least, think of this seal because it's the cute white fluffy babies that, you know, when they come out, they're white and fluffy, as we'll talk about. And so they are kind of poster childs of especially the Arctic species. And there's other reasons why people would have heard about them as well, which we'll talk about. But anyway, I think it's kind of like a poster child seal for many people.
Yeah, they're very, very charismatic seal.
Yes, exactly. I mean, their faces in the light fur is just adorable when they're born.
Super cute.
Okay, so we're going to get started then, and Kat will tell us about their what they look like and their distribution, and before I get into the behavior and diet.
Yeah, so these guys are what we call true seals. So that means that they do not have any external ear flaps, so they just have little holes on the side of their head. And it also means in terms of movement that they are basically moving like a little worm, kind of inching along on the ice floes versus being able to rotate their hips underneath and kind of waddle along like a sea lion does. So just a little bit of a visual there before we get started. So these are the true seals. Harp seals are about 5 to 6 feet in length. They can weigh up to about 260 to 300 pounds. And as you might expect with an Arctic species, which we'll get into in just a second, they do have a pretty stocky and robust body. So again, to be able to have those additional fat stores and everything that they need.
Insulation
is key. and so in terms of where these guys do live, they are found in the cold subpolar and polar waters of the North Atlantic and Arctic oceans. So this is all the way from Russia to the Gulf of St. Lawrence in Canada. And so they spend most of their lives in the water and on the pack ice there, which Cindy will talk about in terms of how that fits into their life history.
Define pack ice, because I know that one.
Oh yeah, go for it.
Yeah. So yeah. Pack ice is basically frozen seawater that is not land fast. So land fast ice is stuff that is connected to the land. So these pack ice are it grows in the winter. they're mobile. So they're like large chunks of ice that are frozen, but aren't connected to the land at all. So it allows them to kind of float and move along, and very important for these seals. So that's what we talk about when we're talking about pack ice, what that means.
Yeah. Good call. So in terms of their populations in general, before we get into more specifics about what they look like, there are actually three distinct populations of harp seals. That are found in the North Atlantic and Arctic oceans. And each of these groups actually does have differences in their, slight differences anyway, in their morphology, genetics, and behavioral characteristics. So they've kind of grouped them based on their pupping sites. And so they are, there is the Northwest Atlantic group, the Northeast Atlantic or Greenland Sea group, is number two. And then finally, the Barents Sea or White Sea group as well. Back in the day, the harp seals were also found in the Baltic Sea, but they have been extirpated from that area for quite some time now, apparently. So what do these guys actually look like? Like Cindy mentioned at the top, they are kind of the poster child, I feel like, for seals in general. So like I said, they're about 5 to 6 feet long, have this stocky, pretty robust body with a small, flat head. The pups, this is what everybody sees pictures of, right? The pups basically start out as white. Their coat is white. It's called a lanugo coat. Lasts until they're about 3 to 4 weeks old.
Yeah, they're like little white puffballs. Like, I
Yeah, I
mean,
was gonna say, I saw your face doing something. I'm like, wait a minute.
but I mean, it like little snowballs basically, and with a little seal face on it. It's pretty ridiculous.
It's super cute. And it's not just there because it's cute. Obviously, that helps. But the white fur does help to absorb sunlight and trap heat in that cold Arctic temperature, and also allows additional camouflage to help hide them from predators when they're on the ice. So, like I said, that lasts about 3 to 4 weeks before they start getting and molting into their different types of coat, which happen at different life stages. I'm going to let Cindy talk about the life stages because it's really interesting. So I'm going to kind of skip ahead into what they look like when they're adult. So the adult harp seals do actually look quite different. So they have a lighter gray fur with a really actually like really attractive kind of black mask on their face. It's very elegant looking. And a curved black patch on their back. And so the reason they have their name of harp seal is because somebody at some point thought that that black patch on their back resembled a harp. Cindy massively disagrees.
I massively disagree. I cannot see it. Like I found a picture that was just the back. I'm like, I'm looking for this. I'm looking for a harp, and I just can't see it. I just so
So basically, y'all need to go Google harp seals and
yeah.
then drop a comment in and let us know if you can see the harp or not.
Yep.
Because we
Perhaps
want to
on
know.
if you're watching this on YouTube, I think I'm gonna put up a pup picture and then also the adult picture so you guys can
Yeah,
see for yourself.
for sure. For sure.
But it's not
So again,
a
well, no. In the eye of the beholder, apparently,
Yeah.
who knows? Maybe harps looked different back in the day when they were naming them, you
That's
know?
true. Okay.
I don't know. It's a pretty name either way.
It is.
So again, mostly light gray. They have this black mask and then this curved black patch on the back. They do also have some dark spots that are kind of randomly scattered over their body as well. And in terms of their other morphology, they have pretty thick front flippers with nice, big, strong claws. And their back flippers have much smaller, narrower claws. So they do have claws on both sets of flippers, which is interesting. Let's see, what else did I want to say?
I would figure that since the pec fins are bigger and stronger, probably for being in the ice and be able to haul up at least some
I
or
think
scratch
so.
through ice, things like
Yeah,
that.
that's fairly typical of the other Arctic species that we've talked about. They typically do have much stronger front flippers and those bigger claws just to be, like you said, to be able to scratch through the ice or to be able to cling on to that slippery ice surface. I think that was about it that I had for their appearance and their distribution. Again, we will be talking, or at least I will be talking mostly about harp seals as a whole. I'm not going to really split it too much into those three distinct populations. We're really going to kind of do the broad species overview, but just to
Thank
make you aware that there are,
you.
make
Awar?
you
Oh, I like
aware that there
this.
are, that
Make
was funny.
it
Wow. There
awar.
are that those three different stocks that we are encompassing in this as well.
Yes. So yeah, those are they all are genetically, morphologically, behaviorally slightly different, but for our terms, basically everything's the stuff we're gonna be talking about is basically the same for all those as far as we can tell. So let's go into their diet and behavior then. And so I actually like I thought we'd have there'd be a little bit more detailed information about these guys because
Oh,
they're
interesting.
pretty well known. But it was a lot of it was just a bit more general. I guess I was just expecting a bit more detail. But for their food, this is real actually very interesting. So we've talked about generalist predators before. Right. And for example, harvest seals eat 60 or more different species. That seems like a lot. These guys eat more than 130 different species of fish and invertebrates. 130.
Wow.
In one study, they found individuals with more than 65 species of fish and 70 species of invertebrates in their stomachs, like in one seal.
Oh my gosh,
Yeah, they're
why?
just like one. Just like tasting the next thing, I guess. I don't know. It's
Weird.
super crazy.
Huh.
And so I that's the most species I've ever seen encompassed in a diet before.
Yeah.
And so it the other thing that's interesting is that they it's most commonly the small fish like capelin, Arctic cod, and polar cod. Also krill. They do eat actually quite a bit of krill. And I'll talk about that a little bit later in one study in the new research. But for a long time, as with other seals that we've talked about here and there, their competition or seen as competition for some commercial fisheries. And so they basically have been the blame a lot and a lot for the Atlantic cod collapse. That's a very
Oh,
commercially
interesting.
important species. But you'll notice I said Arctic cod and polar cod, not Atlantic cod, in their diet, right? And so multiple studies have shown that the impacts from the seals of them eating Atlantic cod are not at all a part of the species decline. And so there was a recent study of Beren et al., and they used a bioenergetics allometric model, basically a model. And they looked at relative contributions of the different drivers on the lack of recovery and dynamics of that cod stock. And basically the dynamics that they saw were best explained by a combination of fisheries removals and capelin availability, so the prey
Deepline.
of the cod, whereas seal consumption was found to not be an important driver whatsoever. Like it did not affect the cod stocks. So it suggests
Interesting.
that the trophic control is bottom up rather than top down from the predator, and that depressed capelin stocks could be a serious impediment for cod rebuilding. So this is why it's so important to know exactly what they're eating, how much they're eating, because just because they eat some or you see them eat some doesn't mean that they're actually impacting that as much as you think they are. So,
Yeah, interesting.
and they eat 130 different species, so they could certainly impact one more than the other, really.
Ah, wow, that's wild.
Yeah. So I found this interesting when I read this. I'm like, they dive up to 1,300 feet. I was like, whoa, that's pretty far. But they're like, they're only a go to 1,300 feet, so apparently not really strong compared to other seals. And they also that they only hold their breath for 16 minutes, and I'm like, that still seems
Lame
right.
comparison.
I was like, geez, fine guys. I mean, 60 minutes seems pretty long to me, but okay.
Also, if
So
you imagine holding your breath in like the Arctic water too, like I'm just thinking they're in like extreme cold water. Yeah, that adds another level of ability to hold your breath.
it's not like 16 minutes in like temperate tropical, warm waters. It's two different things for sure. So anyway, they seem pretty cool to me, but apparently not as good as other seals that we've talked about. So that's basically what we have for diet. For behavior, so these guys also are gregarious in terms of when they gather on pack ice in very large groups during the breeding and molting season. And these can be up to like 1,000 or 2,000 seals. I mean, it's just like
Wow.
party time. Yeah. There was one paper that showed that, or one website that said there were, could be up to 2,000 seals per square kilometer. So,
Oh my gosh.
I mean, they are packed. If there's 2,000
Wow.
seals in that, I mean, that's not even a square mile. Like, square kilometer is smaller than a square mile.
Oh, that'd be so cool to see.
I know, right? Just like, there would be no space.
Yeah.
So when they get out, so they get out to breed, and I'll talk about breeding in a minute with their reproduction. But breeding occurs basically February and March, and then they molt their fur, and we'll talk about that in a second too. But during April and May, then they feed very little during that time, just like most other seals when they molt their hair. And then they go off to feed in the summer and the fall, very intensely, and then migrate back down to the land fast. They migrate down as the land fast ice increases. So the ice that like completely covers everything, you can't get through it. As that increases, they move away, go down to the more southern winter breeding grounds to have their babies and then mate again. Though they did show that some juveniles and some non-breeding adults stay in the north year-round. So if you don't have to
Oh,
go breed,
interesting.
yeah, you wouldn't necessarily need to leave. You just need to make sure you don't get covered in ice. You can't breathe. Yeah.
Okay.
And then there was interesting because the three different populations, there's no evidence of breeding between the populations, right? They're genetically distinct, but they have documented some young seals moving between them. So
Which is
there's a
really
little.
interesting.
So it's like, is that always happen and they just don't breed, or is it something that's starting, maybe we'll start some connections, who knows? Could be quite interesting. And it could very well be that some of those are actually breeding, and then you just don't, if there's only one pup that comes from that, you're not going to see that in genetic assessments, right? It has to be quite a
Right.
few. So it may be happening, you just can't document it. So they'll also feed and travel in large groups. So this is kind of different than a lot of seals. A lot of seals are much more solitary in nature. These guys tend to kind of group together. And so they go during those seasonal migrations. They'll travel away from the pack ice during the summer and follow the ice north to feed in the Arctic. And their annual migration can be 3,100 miles round trip. So
Wow.
they're doing a fair amount for little seals.
If
What's interesting is that you're saying that basically in Canada is kind of their kind of southern range. They have sometimes been seen as far south as New England. So they said it's not unusual, but still rare. So you have
Yeah.
those walkabout animals. Like, I'm gonna go be a tourist in New England. So that would be super cool to see. And so, as Kat did say, they spend most of their lives in the water, but some are known to ride bits of drifting sea ice for short distances during migration, which makes total sense, right? You're
Nice.
tired, just hop
I
on the
would.
ice and float.
Yeah, I totally would. Hitch a ride.
Exactly. Not a bad way to go. Okay, so now here's the really exciting stuff, the reproduction. And Kat and I are excited about this because the names that they have for the different age stages are fantastic.
Awesome.
Their max life is about 30 years, but DFO from Canada said 25 to 40, so somewhere within that. Sexually mature at 7 to 8 for males and 4 to 7 for females, so females start having babies a little bit younger. They mate in the water or on top of ice floes, and the courting rituals include calling, blowing bubbles underwater, making pawing gestures, and chasing females on the ice.
Oh,
So,
that sounds kind of cute.
come hither, female. Come.
So
And then if
cute.
she doesn't, start chasing her.
Right?
In that
That's a little
caterpillar
bit less,
position.
that's a little bit less cute, but I
Yeah.
like the blowing bubble. That's fun.
Yeah, blowing bubbles and making pawing gestures. Okay.
Very cute.
And they'll mate, basically they'll give birth and then mate right after, just like most other seals do, and they have that delayed implantation for about 4 months, where the fertilized egg just kind of floats around in the uterus until 4 months goes by, and then it implants, and then so the total gestation with that 4 months is 11 and a half months, so it makes it so that they are ready to give birth again when that pack ice is available for them, because that's they need that for their birthing. So they give birth in that late February, mid-March, in the southern limit of their range, on that pack ice. And this is where they nurse their pups. As Kat said, each population has a specific pupping site. And so when they're born, they're called yellow coats because when they're first born, they're kind of this tingy yellow. But within a few days, it basically turns into that white fluffy coat that we are all know and love. So that they'll molt that white coat starting at about 10 days and is done by about 3 weeks, like Kat said. And if they still have some white tufts still in it, like they're kind of still in the middle and I haven't quite got rid of it, they're called ragged jackets.
Oh my gosh.
They're just like rough and ready because they haven't fully fledged.
It's like when you see little chicks where they still have some of their kind of downy feathers. They haven't grown into their full feather plumage yet. It looks so cute.
I was literally just thinking the same thing, like little eagles and stuff,
Yep.
they're still kind of flooping.
Yeah, got those little tufts sticking out here and there of their baby feathers.
Exactly.
Oh, fun.
So then they have that till about 3 weeks, and then at that point they have their juveniles now that have a gray with dark spotted coat, and these are called beaters. And when I first heard that, I was like, oh, I think I know why, because as we're going to talk about hunting a little bit, but it's not that. It's because of the sound they make when they learn to swim.
Oh,
Yeah.
I mean, I like that because it's not about, targeting them, but that's, I wonder what the sound is.
I don't know. Like, and why is it any different than any other seal? Like, are they just like so awkward at it that it makes a weird sound? I don't know.
Weird.
So then at 13 or 14 months, and I think this is one of the few seals that has this many different coats. Like, usually it's just you got one and that's it, or maybe two. At about a year old, of 13 to 14 months, they molt again, but the spots remain and they're larger. So it's they kind of coalesce, I guess. And they're called bed lamers.
Oh, the bedlamers?
Bed
Yeah.
lamers.
So bedlam is like insanity, right? Like when you say, oh, it's complete bedlam in there, like it's just nuts. So I was like thinking of it as almost like teenagers where I'm like, where is this? I wonder, but I'm thinking maybe it's more the spots where it's like the spots have kind of gone crazy on their body
Okay.
visually. I don't
Yeah, that
know. But
makes
yeah,
a
that's what
lot more
bedlam means.
sense.
Just bedlam is just like things are nuts.
Because I read it as bed lamers, and I was like, bed lamers? Like, anything about bedlam, like, that makes a lot more sense. Because there was no explanation for that one. I think it's funny they had explanation for every other one, but not that one. But I like that one. I agree
Yeah.
with that. And so they have this bedlam appearance until they reach sexual maturity, when they get their adult coat, which is about 4 to 5 or 6 years of age. And then at the adult, they're called harp seals because they have supposedly a harp on their back in that spot. But if they don't fully develop some of them don't fully develop the quote unquote heart shape, and so they're called spotted harps.
Ooh,
Yeah,
cool.
I think I might like spotted harps better. It's pretty nifty, especially since I can't see the harp in the first place. But that's okay. I digress. So that I think that's one of the most fun naming ones we've had of any species, because they've got like five different names depending on their age.
Yeah, very cool.
I'm going to end with how amazing these animals are in terms of what happens when they're born, being in that cold water. As we've talked about before, in some other species, the more northern species, the Arctic species, basically don't nurse for very long. Super, super high rich, like 50% fat milk. These guys nurse for 12 days. Like, you got to just
Wow.
get it. They gain 5 pounds per day, and develop a thick blubber layer. So when they're first born, they have all the hair to keep them warm, but then they need to bulk up their blubber. And so when they're at 80 pounds, and they started up 25, so they go from 25 to 80 pounds in 12 days.
Oh my gosh.
Isn't that
I mean,
bonkers?
it would be like blowing up a balloon. Like it would just be like physically watching these things just like expand day to day to
Seriously,
day.
I think you could do a time-lapse photography and see them grow like
Oh
within a
yeah.
24-hour period. It's bonkers.
Yeah.
So it's the that ability that it's just very impressive, right? That's a lot to be able to do physiologically. So they do that, and then the females leave the weaned pups on the pack ice, and the females go off to mate. And the pups will stay on the pack ice for about 6 weeks, not eating, very similar to other seals as well. So they'll lose up to half of their body weight. So they just gained like 60 pounds, and then they're gonna lose like 40 of it. Like, it seems like not great evolution, but it works for them. And so basically they get really hungry, and then they'll be like, okay, I guess I'll go into the water and try to figure out how to feed, which they do on their own because mom's not there to teach them.
So I guess it is great then, because otherwise, if the mom was still able to feed them, then they would just continue to be fed, and
Yeah,
they
it
wouldn't actually
forces
take
it.
those first steps to go forage. Interesting.
Yeah. So if you think you have it hard, just think about harp seals that just get nursed for 12 days, left alone, and then have to figure out how to find fish on their own. Maybe that's why they
Yeah,
eat
that's
human
pretty
humans.
hardcore.
It's for real.
Oh yeah, true.
I mean, they're
That's
just
a good
like, I'm going
point.
to eat whatever comes in front of my face,
Yep, I mean, I would.
Right? You got to get that weight back, man. Because if you don't have blubber, you're gonna freeze. You have to have that good blubber layer. So the females will actually do a very intense feeding before going to molt. So they mate. I mean, they give birth. They then go mate. Then they go feed their guts out, and then they will go to molt in April, and before then, heading off to feed regularly. But what's interesting is the males will stay at the breeding area and not feed as heavily or possibly at all, in hopes of mating before molting. So, a female may only
Oh.
have to do like, hey, if I do it a couple times, something stuck, I'm good to go. No point in mating more. But males, they need to mate as much as possible to pass on their genes. So they kind of get the short end of the stick of not getting to feed a bunch before then going into molt for a little
Wow.
Yeah.
But they also didn't have to give birth, so there's that. So they
This is
probably have
also
more,
true.
they have some more reserves to hold up on than the females do.
Good point. Because they didn't say much about the females, but if they're at like any of the other seals we talked about, that lactation process for that 12 days, they probably lost, dozens of pounds
Yeah.
in
I
that
mean, if it's
process.
that high of a milk fat
Yeah.
content, they're gonna lose some weight through that for
Yeah.
sure.
So they need to go then do some intense feeding before they then don't feed for a while to molt.
Yeah.
Whereas the males don't have to do that. So pros and cons, right, to each side. So that is the very, very interesting story of how harp seals are born and what they do during the day. So basically, they're just migrating, feeding, and hanging out on pack ice. That's pretty much what I got for behavior. So
Nice.
yes. So with that, we will take a quick break and be back with the threats and some new research. We'll be back in just a minute. Hello, listeners. This is Cindy, the research director at Pacific Mammal Research, and I wanted to take just a minute to thank you for listening and supporting our work. And I wanted to see maybe if you wanted to learn a little bit more about the background of what we do and what we see in the field and other kind of cool information that you can get by subscribing to the podcast for only $5 a month. You can get ad-free episodes as well as these mini episodes where we discuss the things we've seen in the field, the stuff we've gone to with workshops, and other little interesting tidbits of information for our subscribers only. This is a great way to help support PacMam, who we are a very small nonprofit, so every dollar helps us continue the work that we do and provide the information and the fun podcast that we have that hopefully you guys are enjoying. So if you can, think about it, subscribe to the podcast and help support our work, and we hope you enjoy. All right, we're back. Now, Kat's going to tell us about their population status and their threats. And just a warning to begin with, the next two sections are going to be talking about hunting. These seals are still actively hunted. We're not going to try to dwell on it too much or the details of it, but just so you know, that is something we'll be discussing if you don't want to hear about it.
Thank you. Thank you. So, in terms of how these guys are doing worldwide, it seems like they're actually doing fairly well as far as we know. From what I could find, there are approximately about 9 million animals globally, with the vast majority of those in the Western North Atlantic stock. So, that's like around about 7 million seals are actually part of that Western North Atlantic stock. So, it's the
It's like
vast
all of
majority.
them. It's
Yeah,
like
the
all of
vast
them.
majority of there. The Greenland sea population is around about 430,000. That's the smallest population. And the Barents and White Sea population is 1.49 million at last estimate. So, again, like solid sort of three quarters to slightly over three quarters is that Western North Atlantic stock. They are listed as a species of least concern by the IUCN because of this, fairly decent sized population globally, and the fact that the population has significantly increased from, for example, the 1970s, which we will talk about in just a second as to why. And the individual stocks do fall under management bodies within Canada, Greenland, Norway, and Russia. So these countries are basically, there's a joint scientific working group that helps to advise these different countries and create some sort of cohesion between how their stocks are managed, which I thought was actually very cool and kind of why I wanted to make a point of bringing that in here, because we don't often talk about how difficult it is to manage species that do cross different countries and different international boundaries that are not relevant to the animals. But of course, they're very relevant to us and how we effectively conserve them. So I thought that was pretty neat that there is this kind of joint scientific work group that actually helps to facilitate and advise the different countries on how to manage these stocks.
Yeah, there's, I mean, that goes into, tragedy of the commons, especially if you're talking about hunting. If one country is doing a whole bunch of hunting, knowing the other one, you're not, you may end up having a decline even though you didn't do anything, but the other country did, so you have to have that conversation. So it's really great that they are actually doing that.
Yeah, and especially when you do have very different population sizes. So, for example, if you're talking about the Greenland stock, you may manage them differently than that Western North Atlantic stock too.
And I'll talk about
So I just
that.
wanted to kind of throw that in there.
Yeah, and I'll talk about that actually in the one of the new research was talking about the differences in the popula in those three populations and what affects them and how different those are. So it's very important to m manage them differently.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. So we've mentioned, we're getting into the threats now. So we've mentioned hunting already quite a lot. But basically, the harp seals are one of the most well-known hunted seals. They have been hunted for thousands and thousands of years by the indigenous peoples of the Arctic, as well as by some coastal northern European peoples. In terms of commercial hunting, this has been in effect since at least the 1600s. I believe that was when it first started being documented. And typically, they're being captured and killed for things like their meat, their fur, their blubber, which is then turned into oil, their skins, and also their reproductive parts, which are used in some like Chinese, sold to things for like Chinese medicine and things
Like
like that.
aphrodisiac kind of things, yeah.
Yeah. So those are, they're using most of the animal really, in terms of what they are being for. The peak of these catches was occurring between about 1818 and 1862, when about 500,000 seals were hunted annually. Maximum yearly takes of, I believe, up to about 750,000 seals. So this is why when we're talking about the night, this continued for centuries, right? So this was going on and going on. And so by the 1970s, there were less than 1.5 million seals in that Western North Atlantic stock that were thought to make up the population. So just to see how much it's rebounded just since the 1970s is pretty wild.
It's amazing.
Yeah. Because part of the reason that that has occurred is that DFO in Canada, Department of Fisheries and Oceans, does set an annual total allowable catch for commercial, Aboriginal, and personal use hunting. So this is again very important to note that there are these different types of hunting that is being done still. Again, there is also some level of moderation of that within the different countries as well. Greenland, Russia, Norway, etc. Currently, harp seals are taken mostly in the Canadian and Norwegian commercial hunts and in the Greenland and Canadian Arctic subsistence hunts as well. And there have also been several rules put into place regarding what age class the pups must be in or the seals must be in for them to be allowed to be killed, in order to prevent, basically the Lanugo pups that when they're first born, like they are no longer allowed to be taken because that then prevents the population from rebounding. So things like that have also been put into place to try to allow these populations to recover, and for again to it for it to become some sort of a sustainable process. Because it is important to note that a lot of people in that part of the world in the Arctic region rely on the meat, the fur, the blubber, the skins. Like they are used, like I said, that is one kind of good thing about this is they really are using all of the animal, and it's essential for the survival basically in that part of the world.
Yeah, I mean it's always hard to see, when you kill animals, even if it's needed, it's very hard, but I just find it much better if it's w oh. Way, way worse if they're just like, oh, I'm just using this one thing. I'm killing this animal for this one thing, not doing it. If you're using the whole animal, it's reasonable, right? It's like that's the nature, nature is nature, right? There's going to be killing and predators and prey and all that kind of stuff. And so if at least you're using all of it, that's at least going to, there's nothing's going to waste, which is good.
Yeah. So that really is the main, really, that's the main threat for these guys. There are several more that I'll mention, but that, of course, as we've already talked about, that really is the biggest threat to their population. And thankfully, like I said, there is quite a bit of management going on around it in an effort to, prevent depletion of the population to an unsustainable degree. So with the increase in numbers in that population, it seems to be working, which is great.
Yeah, and some of the re new research I have kind of documents that as well. But it's interesting too that this is, I think, one of the few marine mammal species that has such a large scale in comparison hunt, where most everything else is like, don't you know, we don't do that anymore. But this one is kind of the
Yeah.
exception, which is interesting.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. So the other big one to mention in terms of threat is, of course, climate change, because they rely on the availability of suitable sea ice to use. Like Cindy mentioned, the sea ice is essential for basically all parts of their life history. And so they are one of the more sensitive species to climate change that would impact sea ice formation and or breakup, as well as the timing of that occurring. So again, like was mentioning, they're almost on a timer, right? They have these very specific periods of doing specific life behavior or life history behaviors. And if you start to shift the timing of when sea ice is available versus when it's not, you could have things like, the delayed implantation goes all wonky, right? Where you're not actually giving birth at the correct time anymore because things are all starting to change around you. So it's not just the sea ice itself, it's also the timing and the environmental shifts that are causing those changes. That could also directly and indirectly impact those animals.
The tropic mismatching is the term for
Oh
that
yeah.
when you have basically that timing is off. Like, oh, the flowers bloom and the birds come here to the nectar, but then if they go at the wrong time, they don't get there and the flowers are gone, and then they're that. So it's that kind of idea that we're talking about there with the sea ice and if they have doing things at the right time.
Yeah, and that's the thing. We're like, on an off year, okay, that might not be devastating, but if that starts to become a consistent thing where it's just too variable, that's a massive problem for their populations. Some other things that they are at risk of, vessel strikes. So again, they are, interacting with vessels up in the Arctic as well. Inadvertent vessel strikes can injure or kill harp seals. They are more vulnerable than some other Arctic species to that, I think, just because they are navigating in that the more slightly more open water. They're traveling in those areas between the ice flows. But of course, if they live in coastal areas with heavier ship traffic, that's obviously a much higher risk of vessel strike. And also, they're small. So if you're on a big vessel and you don't see it, you're probably not going to see it. It's too small. It's not like a massive fin whale that you probably would see in the water, Entanglement is another one. So they are known to become entangled in fishing gear or other types of marine debris. So again, we've talked about this in multiple different podcasts. This is really just becoming a generic threat for anything that lives in the ocean, really, at this point in time. They are prone to entanglement with many different gear types, including gill nets, trawls, purse seines, or weirs. Again, like all these other species we've discussed before, this can be a direct mortality in terms of either choking or strangling, not drowning because they can't reach the surface because they're too entangled, or it can be more of an indirect effect where they drag the gear for long distances. It prevents them from hunting correctly. Fatigue could increase their injury risk, and of course that leads to reduced ability to breed and feed, really.
And that's going to be more extreme in an Arctic environment because the environment is extreme. So you have to deal with those cold waters, and it limits you a lot. So the small amounts that might reduce how much you eat will have larger impacts for those animals.
And also, you're not, this is a little bit different than, say, cetaceans, whales and dolphins and porpoises that spend their whole life in the water. Seals are not really spending the whole, especially these guys, they don't spend their whole time in the water. So if they are entangled and it's harder for them to get up onto the ice because they keep being dragged back down, they're not able to spend that much time in that water before they have to get out to prevent hypothermia. So
And even just rest,
it,
like just to
yeah.
just to
Exactly. Yeah, they can't just kind of chill and just like take a breather in the water because it's some warm tropical water. It's a little bit different for them, as you said. A couple others here before we wrap up with these, the chemical contaminants. So again, we've talked about that a lot with other species as well. But because these guys do have pretty solid blubber stores, they are more prone to bioaccumulation of contaminants in their bodies, which, of course, as we've discussed in other podcasts, leads to immune and reproductive system problems. It can lead to direct toxicity poisoning. If they become nutrient depleted and they have to activate those blubber stores to survive off of, they start basically dosing themselves with the chemicals that have built up in there. And then finally, oil spills and energy exploration. This is becoming a common one with Arctic species that we talk about, simply because offshore oil and gas exploration has been much more common up in the Arctic in recent years. And this basically has, again, those kind of direct or indirect impacts on harp seal populations. So the most significant risk for them would be basically an accidental oil spill, or an accidental spill of other toxic substances. And of course, because they are not 100% water dwelling, their coat is the only thing that can repel water. If they get covered in oil, the coat loses its ability to repel water and they freeze.
Pretty quickly, I would
And of
think.
course, also, oh yeah, I mean, up there, yeah, it would probably be a matter of minutes, I would imagine. You wouldn't have long. Of course, obviously, if they are then inhaling or swallowing any of those, oil or toxic substances, that can damage their reproductive tract, digestive tract, respiratory centers, and central nervous system as well. So that's becoming, like I said, much more of a consistent theme with Arctic species of this threat of oil spills because of the continued exploration up in the Arctic. So just something to bear in mind. Thankfully, hasn't happened on a massive scale at this point, but it's more the more work and the more effort we have going on up there, the more development occurring, the more likely it is for that to happen at some point. So
Yeah,
that is all we have for the threats for the
I
harp
would imagine
seal.
too. It's kind of harder to clean stuff up too with oil spills up way up there than down in other locations.
Yeah, well, and that's the thing. That's a really good point because, right, because you don't have as many eyes on the water, number one. And then how do you get, service vehicles up there to help contain that oil spill or that toxic spill and work in that environment? It's
They're not
really
meant to be in
challenging.
that kind of icy environment.
Yeah, really, really challenging. So yeah, that's a great point too. It's much harder to clean up and kind of restrain in a small area.
Yep. All right. Well, I was telling Kat before we started, I was like, I have a hard time finding some newer research on these guys. I don't know, just because there's so many of them that there's not as much detail. But I was able to find a few, and they basically mainly are talking about either, hunting, ontogeny, so how they grow into different age classes and things like that, and their morphology. And then effects of climate change. So I'm going to start off with the one about the harp seal hunt and then stop talking about hunting. But this one was interesting because it's doused in Caraguel et al. Or doused in Caraguel 2012. The Canadian Harp Seal Hunt: Observations on the Effectiveness of Procedures to Avoid Poor Animal Welfare Outcomes. So I thought this was a good one because they are looking to, like, how can we do this hunt the most ethical, the most in the most ethic way possible, ethical way possible, to, you can kill them, but can we kill them quickly and do it, with least amount of pain? So they went over several seasons that aimed at obtaining more specific information about the conditions under which the seals are killed in order to assess these welfare issues and explore any avenues for possible improvements in practice. There is a standardized three-step process for killing seals. Stunning, checking by palpitation of the skull, and then bleeding. And that was recently implemented to maximize the proportion of animals that are killed rapidly with minimum pain. So again, they are trying to make this as good as possible for, what they're doing. And the study basically found based on current practices, there is no reliable evidence that the Canadian harp seal hunt differs from other forms of exploitation of wildlife resources from the perspective of animal welfare. So basically, it seems like they're doing what they should be doing in order to make this the least amount of pain for the animals, which w was nice to know that they are actively looking into that,
And this is, I think, again, it's one of those that it's a very, how do I say, like very widely publicized hunt as well. There's a lot of pictures. If you just Google harp seals, one of the first pictures you'll see is, from a hunt of harp seal pups, or not, well, not pups, but juveniles. So it's one that I think people have seen a lot of imagery of, which is not common for these subsistence hunts or commercial hunts. They're not really documented visually in the same way that I think harp seal have been. So it's interesting that I could see people kind of really getting up in arms because it looks terrible. So it's interesting that they actually did undertake that and found that it's really the best that they can do under the circumstances and what they're doing.
And I think they
Very
did
cool.
talk about there was a specific type of like hatchet or knife that they use. I can't remember the actual name of it. And then they actually some of them do rifle, and saying basically that the while the rifle works, but it's not good if they end up going in the water because then you're not sure if you got them and they could have prolonged, things like that. So they were really looking into the different ways and
Thorough.
making good recommendations of what should be done. So if it has to happen, at least it can happen in a way that is the least amount of pain for the animals. So moving on from that now, the next one is Stenson et al. At 2020. This is harp seals, monitors of change in differing ecosystems. So this is the one I referenced before when you were talking about the different groups. And they actually looked at historic hunting data to look at population trends and the factors influencing them over time. So they could look at, okay, well, how much was the hunt that year and the size of the population. And so basically, there's a lot of details in there, but what I want you to come out with is that each of the populations has been impacted differently by changes in their ecosystems, like prey availability and other mortality besides the hunt, and then also hunting practices. So what they were saying is that if we identify the factors influencing these three populations, we can gain a better understanding of how species may respond to changes that are occurring in their ecosystems. So there was differences in their prey, in other mortalities, diseases, things like that, along with the hunting practices between those three different populations and why they should be managed separately, right? That they're not all the same. You can't just put a blanket thing over all three of them because there's different stuff going on.
Yeah, interesting.
So again, good that they're looking into these things, right? And to make that sustainable as needed. Another one. So now we're going to go into, I think I'll do climate change. Yeah. And then the rest of it is about, physiological stuff. But Stenson et al. 2016, a lot of these are the very, a lot of same authors on these papers. The impact of change in climate and abundance on reproduction in an ice-dependent species, the Northwest Atlantic harp seal. So climate change, as we've kind of discussed, has been shown to affect harp seals directly through increased mortality of young. So the babies don't survive. They increased from, as you said, 101.5 million seals in the early 70s to 7.4 million seals today. That was in 2016. But since 1987, late-term abortions have been observed. So there's been a lot
Wow.
of, like aborting a fetus later in the process. There were pregnancy and abortion rates were estimated from samples between 1954 and 2014 off Newfoundland. And they did a model that included Kaplan biomass and midwinter ice cover to see what was, correlated. And what they found was harp seals appear to respond to relatively small variations in environmental conditions when they are at high population levels. So it was observed. If the observed changes in climate continue, negative impacts on the Northwest Atlantic harp seal population will likely increase due to the predicted warming trend and associated reduce in ice cover. So even though they're doing well, the environment and the sea ice that you talked about with climate change, and then corresponding prey, if they're eating a lot of capelin, will have small variations in that can have large impacts on this population, which then goes into monitoring and seeing that and then adjusting how much hunting is being able to be done in that population, as was talked about in the last paper. So all those things go together to have a more sustainable population and sustainable harvest. So then this one's my favorite title. It's by Gimuka et al. 2015, The Fat and the Furriest: Morphological Changes in
Oh my
Harp Seal
gosh, I love it.
with Antogeny. Isn't that great? The Fat and the
That's
Furriest.
awesome.
So this is interesting. They looked at basically how things develop as they get older. So the hair becomes flatter and shorter in older animals, and the density decreased with age because you get more blubber, right? You're relying less on the hair and more on the blubber as you get older. The number of hair bundles per unit area and average number of underhairs present in any given bundle changes associated with happen, and then changes associated with reduced thermal resistance of the pelt, again relying more on blubber. And this is consistent with what's known for the evolutionary patterns of fur morphology associated with that transfer from transition from blubber to from fur to blubber in aquatic species. So there's nothing new, except that this was the first time they showed that across age classes in a single species, which I thought was kind of cool. So they're really showing that, yes, this is exactly what happens and why. And overall, the timing of these ontogenetic changes may limit the ability of harp seals to adapt to the deterioration of sea ice in the Arctic as predicted with continued climate change. So again, that mismatch timing. If things aren't happening at the right time frame, they're going to get too cold too quick and they're going to not make it. So important to know
interesting
those how that develops with how things are changing. So now we're going into a little bit into diet. Lindstrom et al. 2012, harp seal foraging behavior during summer around Svalbard in the northern Barents Sea, diet composition and the selection of prey. So this was in the Barents Sea ecosystem. And they show that the harp seal diet composition varied significantly both in time and space, and their diets appeared to be size dependent. So in this particular location, the subadults and adults were mainly looking at pelagic crustaceans. Adults were mainly looking at fish, but krill was the most important prey species at 63%, and then polar cod 16%, and other fish 10%. So the end product of that is prey preference of harp seals varied in time and space, which makes sense if they eat like 130 different things. So, but again, goes back to those different populations, right? Whatever's available, wherever they are and whatever's available will vary between these populations, which goes into how well they do with different climate changing things and all that kind of stuff. So the last one I have here is a little interesting. It's Graal Nielsen et al. 2011. Fatty acids in harp seal blubber do not necessarily reflect their diet. So this is where you take blubber samples and look at the fatty acid composition, and you can look at isotopes and things like that and determine what they're eating. This is very common in a lot of different species studies. But what they found was interesting. They did the Northwest Barents Sea in 2006, and they took the fatty acid composition of potential prey and the inner and outer sections of the seal blubber. So because the level where the blubber is can have the composition of the molecules and chemicals in there can change over time as it moves through the layer. The blubber was basically was stratified, had different stuff on the outer layer versus the inner layer. The fatty acid composition differed substantially among the potential prey species and between the prey and the blubber. So there was a lot of not matching, basically, is what was happening. And so what they found was that there was a weak predator-prey relationship with respect to that fatty acid composition of the inner blubber layer. And the prey suggested that the fatty acid composition of the inner layer was mainly predetermined by metabolism rather than the actual diet. So basically, you can't use the inner blubber layer or maybe all the blubber layer to estimate prey for these animals, which you can for many other species, which was kind of cool.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of those things, again, that's like sounds kind of like you read the title, you're like, okay, why do we care? But then also that's really, really important for how you're doing these types of analyses. That's awesome.
Yeah, because I mean, like I said, it's very common for species. They take samples and then you can figure out what they're eating and it matches up really well with it. And for these guys, it doesn't, which is very interesting. It's kind of extreme dudes. So that's what I got for harp seals. And I think we've spent our time here. So remember the cute little white fluffy guys that turn into larger guys with a parent harp on their back, or maybe a spotted harp if they're lucky or not lucky. I don't know which. what you want to have as your decoration on your body, but we will have all our notes listed, and so next episode will be a general review. So
The next episode might actually be an end of year one, because
it is the end of the year.
It is going to be the end of the year, so the next episode will actually probably be some kind of end of year wrap up for us.
Unless something super crazy comes out that we really want to talk about.
Right. In which case then we'll do that. But stay tuned. Who knows? We'll keep you guessing.
It's a mystery. But if there's anything you want us to talk about, please let us know on our social media or email channels. We are having our annual end of year fundraiser. So if you can and are willing to and want to donate, please do. It helps keep our research going and provide these educational opportunities like the podcast and other videos we have on our YouTube channel. And you can we'll have a link to that in the show notes as well. Any amount is super helpful for us as a small nonprofit. You can also get merch, so go to our gift shop and get the cool everything you could ever want for people who love porpoises and seals and Pac-Man. Great gift ideas. Anyway, so that's ways you can support us, which we really are appreciative, and we thank you so much for this year of your support and listening. So keep an eye out on our social media channels, and we will see you next time. Bye.
Bye.
This was brought to you by Pacific Mammal Research, a 501c3 nonprofit organization. Head to our website, www.pacmam.org, that's PACMAM.org, to check it out. Also, help us continue providing fun and educational content like this by donating today. Your help is how we can continue to do our work and share it with you. Thanks.